think the three papers give us different aspects of the same phenomenon, which is not only crisis and the south of Europe. Chrysos' paper is much more general and broad and brings a lot of the theoretical questions there. And I think then we have some focus on a specific issue, which is the social policy from Manos' paper and Ben's on the public opinion. I think all three papers are coming back to the same theme, which is trust in institutions and in public policy in different ways, from a public opinion point of view, from a social policy, or from a social capital point of view. That's the general bit, and I will just turn to Chrysos' paper, which I found very interesting and rich, and it's good to know that it will become a book, because it is a little bit cramped, so it needs space to be developed. My comments is, first of all, choosing Europeanization and social learning as your framework seemed natural at the beginning of the paper, but by the end of it, I thought you were saying more actually about theories of trust rather than about Europeanization. So it would be actually interesting, and we were discussing that in a previous panel on Europeanization, to try to link the two frameworks and to see if you can come up with some more original hypothesis, like, for example, you mentioned later in the paper and in your presentation the quality of governance variables that I think could be integrated even more in the paper, also in the analysis, but also in the discussion of the case study. So you could have these variables somehow giving a plan to the paper and then giving some information about Europeanization. Now the macroeconomic adjustment discussion, I thought it was very interesting, but of course it's very new. Things are happening as we talk, so it will be, I guess, it will need, well, we will need some time to be able to evaluate, and you say that in your paper, and to actually focus it on the reform, because at the moment it's more of a discussion of what's happening, but we don't know what the reform is going to actually be, you know, at some point. And of course cohesion policy is something that I've been working for a long time, and it's much easier, I think, to focus, and it shows in the paper. I think that's all I have written. I don't want to take more time. I'll give it to Dimitris to discuss the other two papers and then open it up.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Manos' paper first. Where is it? I've got just a couple of points, really. I was wondering if you may want to respond to that. The first one has to do with the data. It's just a procedural point. We know that the Greek Statistical Agency has changed the way it measures things because it has been found to be slightly dodgy in doing so before. So how comparable is the data from 2011, I think, 2010, 2011 onwards, from what we're going to have from now on, and the period before, particularly when you try to measure poverty, risk of poverty, rates, and so on. I wonder whether, in other words, the same data set for Greece running through, say, from the early 2000s until now, is as reliable as the equivalent we have for other countries in the EU. With regard to the pension reform that you have discussed, I was wondering if you want to say a few words in terms of ways in which Greece, and I suppose this point will apply to other countries in South Europe and beyond, can actually meet some of the challenges of not being able to reform their public policies. What I'm thinking in particular is a potential way forward that in my own research I thought is quite useful in trying to explain differences in policy outcomes when reform attempts are made, and in particular I'm considering here the role of discourse in fostering change, and in particular whether you think that an approach such as discursive institutionalism, i.e. trying to bring in from an institutional approach the role of public discourse in becoming a persuasive agent of change, is useful for the case of Greece. A more practical question follows. Lately we have had the promised in the 2010 law revision of the supplementary pension funds estimates, and they seem to suggest that more pension cuts will result out of these new actuarial studies. What do you reckon the distributional consequences of this to be for the Greek pension system? A final point. Unfortunately, one of the most interesting parts of your paper you didn't have the time to discuss, and that was, of course, the way forward again, how to reform the Greek welfare state. My interpretation of what you are saying, not only in this paper, but throughout your contributions to public policy in the Greek debate, seems to be that you are somehow hinting at the need for combining a sort of flexicurity for Greece. In other words, bring the social protection, social assistance elements closer into the way the labour market works. And perhaps one could say that some of the recent changes that the Greek government has been forced to introduce go to that direction. My question is, if that is indeed the case, that's up to you, of course, to say whether it is or not, but if it is, do you think that this is, in fact, viable right now, considering that the concept of flexicurity itself in the European Union is currently under heavy fire, and especially on the part of trade unions, which, as we know, are quite fisty in their own demands in Greece, is currently being very negatively perceived. To Ben and Kyriaki's paper very briefly, it was very nice reading your paper, but it's always difficult to discuss it when one's own area of work, like mine, doesn't really fall at all within the public opinion field. So a few of the questions that I would like to pose to you just for the sake of the discussion are the following. There could be perhaps a bit more data in the paper about the interpretation of results. Somewhere I found a couple of sentences which were very, very interesting, and for those of you that haven't had the pleasure, really, of reading the paper, let me just point out one. If I recall it correctly, women in Greece, you found, to be more distrustful or somehow less positive about the benefits of the euro introduced to the country. And one could start really speculating, and perhaps I'm inviting you to do that, just to speculate or try to give us informed opinions as to why this may be. One interpretation could be that more women would be, you know, concentrated in public sector employment and somehow would make the link to the conversion of the currency has been made elsewhere. But what do you think about this? More generally, you talk about political cues at the beginning of the paper, yet you don't really analyze them later on. So perhaps you may want to say a few words about that. Secondly, the data is static, May 2010. Do you intend to make it more longitudinal? Finally, the paper is very good and very useful as it is. I thought that some of the questions, absolutely fitting to a Southern European panel, but going through some of the questions that you had in the slide as well as in the paper, I was wondering, it would be ideal if some of those questions were posed to core Eurozone countries as well, in particular to countries such as Germany, or if you like, the AAAs, as they're called nowadays, who could perhaps provide us with some clues as to a more comparative framework of how countries see the politics of EU reform. Thank you, and we can do it the way you like, I suppose. You can immediately respond to those very challenging points, or we may just open it to the public to add more questions, and you keep on taking notes, as you wish. Christo Mano, Ben Kyriaki. Okay, yeah. So, shall we begin with the discussion? We have 25 minutes, so Dimitri.
Just a comment on Manos' paper, which I enjoyed very much. I think that there are two stories here. One, and perhaps more dramatic, is the effect of this kind of austerity measures on Greece, and Manos demonstrated that exquisitely, I thought. But there is also a European element, an EU element to this. Because, of course, one should not forget that the question of pension reform, as well as that of labour market flexibility, flexicurity, call it as you wish, have been part of the EU's agenda for a number of years now. And indeed, they have been part of the EU's monitoring instruments under Lisbon for 7 and perhaps 10 and more years. Today. I think what we are witnessing in the case of Greece, and it's perhaps something that we are likely to see a lot more as European economic government develops in the years to come, is that a major policy shift from what would now seem as a failed model of policy coordination under Lisbon when it comes to pension reform in particular, to something that it is much more hands-on. So much so that it has almost become a formal conditionality on the bailout plans. Although I don't like the term bailout, but it is effectively what we what we're seeing, that a major precondition for financial assistance has been the reform of this. And to me, this European dimension of the Greek drama is interesting, because it first of all raises bigger questions about Lisbon and the Lisbon agenda, and the limits of it in the evidence we have now, about the poor implementation of it, but also the kind of things that are likely to come up in the near future. And that's something perhaps that is relevant to many people here, right?
Thank you. Yes, please.
Two short questions for two of the presenters, and then a slightly longer one for Christos here. Question to Ben is, I was interested in your using sort of cosmopolitan and non-cosmopolitan identities as a sort of independent variable. But I also wondered whether you considered the impact of the crisis itself as an independent variable on cosmopolitan and non-cosmopolitan identities. The second question is, Manos, have you or anyone else looked at the impact of the pension reforms upon the proportion of GDP going to pensions? Whether it's actually going to make any difference or not. And to Christos, I was struck by the slide which looked at sort of the relationship between corruption, trust and equality. And you seem struck by the fact that inequality in Greece is relatively low, and indeed, intuitively, one would think that corrupt systems are more likely to be highly inegalitarian than non-corrupt systems. But of course, this isn't necessarily the case, because there's corruption and then there's corruption. And certain forms of highly evolved clientelism or patronage or whatever you want to call it, can, of course, have certain kinds of distributed effects. And I was very struck by a seminar at Warwick by not a Greek academic, somebody used to work in the Greek private sector, a guy called Aristos Doxiades, I think. Yes, you know him, who's writing a book, or has finished writing a book, on the cultural political economy of Greece, who make precisely this point that Greek clientelism is in fact redistributive. So the question I put to him, and I cannot remember his answer, well, why not leave it alone then? as it is. So anyway, I just wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
Thank you very much. Limit.
Thank you. To Manos Matsakanis, I wanted to ask, have you followed the pace of implementation of this pension reform after June 2010? Because I understand that part of the reform is not being implemented. Do you have any information on this? And to Ben and Iaki, I would like to ask you if you could explain how come trust in the European Union collapses so much after the European Union has stepped in to support the failing economies with funds? I noticed in your graphs that you don't have only a negative trend, you have a collapsing trend, particularly after May 2010, which is strange. And on the point on the which you made, I think that we have enough data on Greece saying that it is a very unequal society. The Gini coefficient for Greece is above 34, and the ratio between the top 20% and the lowest 20% is about 5. So people who are rich earn 5%, 5 times more income than people who are poor. And then you factor in the fact that you have a large underground economy, about 30% of the Greek GDP, to which underground economy, the salaried strata do not have access, so whereas the self-employed have access, and liberal professionals like doctors and lawyers and engineers and businessmen also have huge access. So both in the official economy and the unofficial economy, I think you have large income inequalities in Greece. But you may want to comment.
Let us take one more, and then we can ask the paper givers to respond.
Yes, from Venezuela, I have a question for Ben and Chidia. It's a methodological question. You say that in your comparison between the groups, which groups trust the EU more or less, I was wondering if you already did it, if you control for the, like it seemed to be the middle income group, who seemed to be the group that believed the most in the EU. So I was wondering if you took account of that, and I was also curious if you could, if there was a trend like, okay, this group is maybe the most trusting one, but okay, we don't have long terms in the paper, but can you see any trend if you compare to other data that is older, if the trust has also declined among those people, even if they show the kind of trust today? And then there's one more small question also related to your paper. Is it important in your study to try to detect, because you have micro-level data, if people were affected by the crisis and then how serious?
Okay, thank you. Let's try and take the first round of responses.
Thanks very much all for the points. With regard to Stella's points, I think your suggestion to bridge actually the gap between theories of trust and Europeanization is in the making. I think I've done this up to a point, given that I use the theories of trust, as I explained, in trying to identify levels of capacity for collective action within the networks. And given that the role of networks is known in the Europeanization literature, I mean, this is the stage where I am at the moment. You made a key point with regard to the so-called quality of government measures, and because I didn't have time during my presentation, first of all, these measures are, this index is a very complex composite index, okay? And it draws primarily on World Bank data and on other sources, not only World Bank. To put it another way, the World Bank, as it's called, World Bank Index of Governance, etc., draws on other well-known surveys such as Freedom House, World Value Surveys, Transparency International. In any case, therefore, in that respect, this all has to be disentangled. All this, I mean, I presented just the graphs here, but in any case, all this, I think, it has to be explained, and partly it is in the paper. Now, there is a related discussion, which I didn't mention before, and it is actually between democracy and quality of government. We used to think that democracy goes hand in hand with quality of government. This is supposed to be, I mean, other question nowadays. I mean, there is especially given the experience from Eastern Europe, where democratization brought actually a situation with high corruption, etc., etc. But then, in any case, this relationship is question mark nowadays. Therefore, democracy is considered as a necessary but not sufficient condition for quality of government or governance. Okay, that's the second thing. With regard to the corruption, inequality, etc. point, I think in any case, in both those phenomena, there is a debate about methodology and accuracy of measurement. Okay, Dimitris Sotiropoulos made such a point with regard to inequality. And of course, the graph I presented was based on Gini coefficient measurements, And I know that Gini, and of course it was mid-2000, which means roughly 2005, and I know that Gini is not the only, and probably Manos can help in that respect. There are other measurements of inequality. But in any case, I would buy your point that I think it seems, at least, it seems that there is indeed, a reluctant redistributional effects of clientelism in the Greek case. Therefore, if we get into this discussion, we might end up with comparing clientelism, the Greek clientelism vis-à-vis Portuguese clientelism, because both, I mean, supposed to have a tradition of clientelism, but okay. And I think
clientelists now.
Yeah, yeah. But in that respect, I think Dimitris Sotiropoulos' point with regard to the, for instance, the role of black economy, or as we call it, shadow economy, in up to a it might be considered as a sort of, curing high levels of inequality, given that it has some redistributive effects, given that several professionals, or not necessarily lawyers, doctors, etc., but other, there are a lot of professionals, like, for instance, people working in households for fixing things, plumbers, so on and so forth. Though these also belong to so-called black or shadow economy, therefore, in that respect, they might be, in fact, in a better position than they are supposed to be, or declaring to be, in terms of fiscal authorities, so on and so forth. But it's an open question. Thanks.
Thank you. Mom.
Right. I didn't forget anything.
On data, the pension projections are done by the Social Protection Committee and the European Policy Committee of the European Union. Of course, there are many assumptions involved, and some of these assumptions may turn out to be mistaken. But I think the order of magnitude is such that there can be no doubt that Greek pensions were unsustainable. Now, on poverty data, I have never heard anybody suggest that the Greek poverty data are less reliable than other countries' poverty data, because the main source of information is the EU SILP, which is a common European survey done on the same methodology in all countries. That doesn't mean that there aren't issues about the accuracy of this data, but they are taken to be quite reliable, let's put it like this. Now, these data have nothing to do with tax data. People are not assumed to more truthfully reveal their income when they report it to an interviewer from the National Statistical Agency than when they file a tax return. So the poverty statistics are not based on tax returns. But incidentally, our own work on the distributional effects of tax evasion shows that it makes the distribution of incomes more unequal, not less. Now, I'm afraid I'm not very familiar with the role of discourse in fostering change, and I would rather abstain from saying something very silly. In the past, I had done some reading of the literature on advocacy coalitions, which I found quite useful, and I reached the not very profound conclusion that in Greece they were very weak, but perhaps I need to do more reading. I'll read your paper. Now, cuts in supplementary funds. Yes, it's true, supplementary funds were neglected in the first round of pension reform, but they have since come under scrutiny and they're going to be cut, which might be expected. Now, what is likely to be the distributional effect? I can't say very much, except that I wouldn't be surprised if it turned out to be progressive. Because remember, distributional effect is determined by the design of a policy measure, whether it protects the weakest, whether it hurts more the richest, and so on, but also by the position of those affected in the income scale. Mm-hmm. And those who grow supplementary pensions are likely to be located towards the top of the income mm-hmm. scale. They don't know it themselves, and they don't seem to appreciate it, but this is the truth, or rather the truth that income data tells. Now, the way forward. I think I did mention, I explicitly mentioned flexicurity in my paper, but not in the sense that I believe it is a recipe that we only need to apply and that would be it. The whole idea of flexicurity is quite intriguing to my mind, but the preconditions for flexicurity are not there in the Greek case. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a truism, everybody says so, and most people imply that, you know, and a very good thing that the preconditions are not there. I think we should work in order to create the conditions for flexibility, because some of these conditions are good on their own side. Now, the funny thing about flexibility is that one leg of flexibility, greater flexibilization of the labor market, is already happening. So perhaps we will achieve flexibility by doing something about the other leg, which is to strengthen the social safety. Now, the question about the European dimension. It is obvious that coupling a common monetary policy with national fiscal and other sectoral policy was a recipe for disaster, and some people said at the time, and now we can see the results. Social policy is still the domain of national governments. And the shortcut, which was OMC, soft tools, open method of coordination, and so on, proved to be rather ineffective. Or rather, they worked in countries where it was always likely that they would work, and not in other countries. With respect to my case study, which is a pension reform of 2010, it is rather curious that the EU took a secondary role, played second fiddle to the IMF. It was the IMF that called the shots. And it's even more curious. I'd like to see a paper doing research on this. I think it's a very interesting question. That what the IMF did was come up in favor not of the common recipe of the IMF, the Washington Consensus, you know, means tested pension and first pillar pension and a privatized second pillar pension. They did nothing of the sort of this kind. They just came up in favor of a structure which is very much in the European mainstream. And I claim that it is rather Scandinavian in design, but not in generosity, obviously. This is quite strange, and actually it was quite effective. Now, what is likely to be the effect of pension reform on GDP? Well, the Greek government keeps telling the IMF and others that it's going to do the trick and it's going to be hugely effective and work wonders. I have my doubts, partly because many favored groups escaped some or all of the provisions of the pension law. Also because supplementary pensions were forgotten at first. However, there is a clause in the law, the pension reform law, which actually legislates almost automatic further cuts if pension expenditure increases by over 2.5%, 2.5 percentage points relative to its 2010 level, which is not specified, but we know that it's around 12%. So, as the law stands, if pension expenditure goes above 14.5%, which is the current level of the high spenders, mostly and others, today, almost automatically, there will be further cuts. Now, I'm very unconvinced about how it's actually going to be implemented, but the intention of the IMF is there. Now, the point of Dimitris Sotiropoulos about part of the reform not being implemented, I confess I know nothing about it. And I would like to know more. So please tell me.
Thank you. Ben?
Right, okay, I'll take the discussant's point first. Yeah, the interpretation of results, there needs to be more analysis of the findings and some more description of them at the moment. So that's a very useful point that will be addressed. Women less supportive of the euro. I think the general literature tends to find that men are more supportive of EU-related issues than women. Not always, but I think that's the weight of the evidence. You could be quite right that it's down to particular characteristics of men and women in terms of the labour market, occupational sector. Off the top of my head, I don't think the data source carries a question about occupational sector. There are other measures on labour market employment, so it might be that the differences are explained away by other characteristics of occupational sector. Certainly important, and that's worth looking at for, you know, interpreting the findings. Yeah, political cues, as you said, needs further analysis, and it annoys me that we don't get partisanship measures and Eurobarometer, except for those, I think, undertaken around the time of European elections. Longitude analysis is a very good point. The EU support questions on trust and country benefits are asked regularly on the standard Eurobarometer, so that could be done to see whether particular population groups have, you know, have changed in terms of their views. The specific questions on the crisis started being asked in Eurobarometers in early 2009, I think, and there'll be questions in 2011. So there's certainly scope for actually looking more longitudinally over the period of the crisis again to see whether particular groups' variables actually change in relation to those questions. So, and a very good point about the cases we chose, the four countries. There's always a temptation with Eurobarometer to get build up and go up to the 27, and you know you have a much higher end, and etc. Although obviously we were focusing on the four, but you could certainly extend the analysis or carry out another analysis where you analyse public opinion in contributors to the bailout funds and the recipients of the bailout funds. Although it could be potentially that future contributors actually become future recipients, if I'm right in thinking, but that may not happen. But there's certainly a case you could analyse public opinion in these sets of countries to see whether you know, are there similar trends or are they moving in different directions. Okay, if I'm not missing anything out, question on crisis affecting identity is a very tricky question, but a very valid one. The analysis is set up that what you might think of as more core feelings, core attitudes are affecting attitudes on the newer questions related to the crisis, but certainly, you know, this is certainly a perfectly valid argument that things are happening the other way around. It's a much more messy causality, and that you know, people's feelings about identity, cosmopolitanism, are changing, perhaps exclusive national identity is increasing. I think Eurobarometer might vary in terms of the questions it's used over recent years in national identity. I can revisit that, but if there is a similar question, we might get a nice graph which actually shows decline or trend in terms of, you know, cosmopolitanism, national identity. Again, that's something to look at, but it just gets very tricky once you start looking at these attitudes in terms of what's affecting what. We can't do much about that unless we have some sort of panel data where we can have analyse across the ways of guess in terms of what's changing. So probably a very reassuring response to that. Okay, next point. Got trust. How come trust collapsed with the rescue coming in? Well, I guess the rescue mechanism, the bailout fund, and the domestic reforms required haven't been treated with welcome, with open arms and unanimous support. It's been a case of very heavily contested. We tend to see people protesting in cities against their governments. People are also protesting against you know, what they see as the imposition of the support, you know, the conditionality attached to it from the EU and the IMF. So where you might think the EU seen as the white knight riding to the rescue, well, it's not. It's the EU and the IMF imposing conditionality and austerity programs. It's not like it's just being received with open arms, as earlier decades of structural funding has been given as well. So I think, you know, you can see that the external imposition of this, whatever you want to call it, is then getting wrapped up with domestic debates. So that's why there's deploying trust rather than just the plateau of trust or an increase in trust.
Also, they haven't delivered the goods because the crisis is ongoing. It has spread. It has speculation has spread to Italy and Spain. So they haven't really been, you know, whatever they've done hasn't worked so far.
And then there is a couple of very valid points in terms of the methods. We used education as our main sort of measure of people's socioeconomic status. Eurobonds does have questions on income, but of course income tends to be lots of missing data in surveys because people aren't willing to do it. Whereas the questions on education tend to go into missing data for when you then want to do analysis and not lose cases from the sample. But you make also a good point about we could actually look more specifically at particular subgroups, whether it's stratified by education and income or perhaps labour market status, to see whether within particular groups there's been a sharper decline, because the graphs we showed are interesting, but they just show averages across the population in the full country. Mm-hmm. It might be for their particular subgroups, you know, perhaps the less well off in society who actually you can see that trust has declined the most in the more support for the EU. I'm not sure if I've answered your question directly or whether I
okay. There's
anything else.
People affected by the crisis.
And sorry, there was a final point about whether people affected by the crisis in particular. Yeah, I think there are some questions on these Eurobarometers about how the crisis has affected you, but we haven't actually got around to looking at them yet. So that's a very good point. Very good point, because it may be that there are people, you know, that are responding to questions that they've lost income.
Jobs,
lots of jobs, etc. Will do
different
services.
Thank you.
I think that's
just 2 minutes. 1 minute. Thank you all for being here, especially the speakers. And well, it was ambitious to call our panel post-crisis public policy. We can say that for the next 10 years, maybe, and keep the diving. Really, thanks, Jana, for the coordinator of the group on South Europe for helping us to actually put this together. And whoever wants a paper about our next conference, it's here.
Thank you. Thanks very much.